Welcome to another episode of Legacy Leadership, where we share raw and real leadership, thought leadership, and lessons from today's and tomorrow legacy leaders. And today we have exceptional leader that is joining me in this powerful conversation. We're going to be discussing how leadership, intelligence, national security, navigating complexity, specifically right now, as we think all of us are dealing with a lot of uncertainties in the world, don't we? This gentleman not only is being a diplomat and worked in as being scholar, warrior, chief of defense and intelligence liaison, but also diplomat, strategic advisors, professor, lecturer, and so much more. And without further ado, I would love to bring into studio Gustav Otto. Gustav, welcome. How are you?
Good day, Isabella, and thanks for having me. I'm a fan of your show. And I've learned a lot from many of your guests, as well as the really good questions that you've shared. And so I'm excited about how you challenge me for the rest of this period.
Thank you, first of all, for having the time. And second, I know that I couldn't even scratch the surface and do the justice to your tremendous backgrounds. Do you mind just walking us a little bit about your background and how did you get into a military and also became diplomat, scholar, warrior, and national security expert?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. I have to start by saying that these are my views and my views alone, and not those of the U.S. government or the Department of Defense's. In the 80s, I was lucky to be in industry for 6, 7, 8 years in leadership position there. As the first Gulf War happened, I felt that I needed to serve more. Both my real father and my stepfather are public servants, both veterans, and they, along with my amazing mother, instilled in me and all of my brothers the importance of serving our community and our fellow citizens around the world. And so I joined the U.S. military as an Air Force officer. It was a time when we were doing significant cuts, thoughtful strategic cuts, as we were dealing with the peace dividend at the end of the Cold War. So while I hoped to be a pilot on the heels of Top Gun and the popularity of all things being in the air and being a fighter pilot, I didn't get that opportunity. And so they said, you got your undergraduate degree in international affairs and you focused on the Middle East. I said, yeah. And so how about being an intelligence officer? And it sounded really neat. And at the time I thought, is it going to be the kind of intelligence officer who's kind of Jack Ryan providing key analytic insights to executive decision makers in the government, or is it going to be more like James Bond? And as I got into it, it was, and we can talk more about that, but I did get the opportunity to see the world. I did learn to become a human intelligence and counterintelligence professional, where I was running intelligence networks around the globe and looking for some of the greatest threats to American and coalition allies and their intelligence, protecting their intelligence along the way. When I started to get better at it, I found that I was in the room with those key decision makers, whether they were kings, prime ministers, senior generals, executive decision makers in our own country, and had the opportunity to both learn from them and gain wisdom from their wisdom, and also occasionally ask a question, occasionally ask why they made those decisions. And as I started to put these things in the nest, as I became a better leader myself, I started to not just ask questions, but make recommendations, to suggest that people look at things differently, to reframe the way we consider outcomes or the way we consider things being done to us or near us. After about 12 years of doing that active duty, the U.S. government and the Department of Defense made me an offer to lead the intelligence activities on a hard target, on a set of hard targets in the early aughts when we were engaged in wars around the globe, both in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere. It was an opportunity I could not refuse. And so I transitioned to civil service and became a government leader as a civilian. I continued my reserve service and retired from the reserves in 2013. And I am about to retire again as a civil servant, and I'm looking forward to what chapter 3 looks like. During the last almost 20 years, I've been able to hone some of my leadership and gain neat opportunities to represent the U.S. government to our allies, to leverage decision makers' interest in certain things, and make positive changes around the world. Whether that's in nation building and reconstruction when I was teaching at the National Defense University, whether that's advising the chief of staff of the Army when I was at Army University in Fort Leavenworth, or whether that's giving some good ideas and asking those hard questions of a couple of the former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so now I find myself in Canada, where I'm a Defense Intelligence Enterprise leader, working closely most with the Canadian Armed Forces and the Canadian Department of National Defense, but across the Canadian intelligence enterprise, sharing best practices and lessons learned, and also learning how their system is so much different yet complementary to our own American national security. And so I consider myself, yes, a diplomat because I carry a black passport and I have diplomatic immunity. And a scholar because I never stop learning and I love relying on the 3 degrees that I have, but talking to other people, whether it's a janitor or somebody who's a caterer or the bartender, all the way up to the prime minister when they speak. And then I can't deny the fact that I've been to war and I am a warrior. And so all of these kind of come together, coalesce to hopefully make me a better national security expert. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. What a beautiful story. And I love how you tied all the pieces together. And I just have to say again, such an impressive background. Kudos for your service, for everything you did and continue to do. But also wanted to just to say, from leadership standpoint, intelligence itself, national security is also more crucial than ever. And with everything that is shifting happening, and for you also sitting in Canada with all the current events that we're witnessing across the globe, must be also bringing all that phenomenal experience to completely yet another level for everything you have accomplished thus far, because as many would say, we live in very unprecedented times. So, do you mind reflecting a little bit on that?
Yeah, and there's just in the 3.5 years I've been in Canada, there have been some really significant things. I mean, we saw the just the brutal war and the criminal aggression of Putin against the Ukraine, and we saw a coming together of the international community to really kind of call out that aggression and make it clear that it's evil and it's wrong. And that the world, the free leaders of the world will not stand by and let these kind of things happen. We saw a whole bunch of other crises unfold. And when there were opportunities for people to just sign another check or send in money or send some aid, we leaned in together as a global community and said, you know what, we're not going to let these things happen. We're going to make the world a better place. We're going to look for transformational change rather than transactional change. We're going to try to make our own communities better and provide better support to our stakeholders, our friends, and those who believe in democracy and freedom the same way we do. And I see that both in the United States and in Canada. And it's really heartwarming to see that. That we're not alone when we look to Europe or Asia or Africa or South America, and we find those freedom-loving people join us in making a positive change.
Wow, I love the differentiation between being transactional versus transformational, and specifically what we're being known for so long, right? It's like economy, very quick transactions, short runways, short term thinking, and frankly, living versus implications of those decisions and ripple effect on long term, right? And then from diplomatic standpoint and obviously historic and educational standpoint and everything else that you stand for, obviously brings completely different perspective to that. So I'm curious, how do you think the balance between these transformational and transactional leadership is happening right now from national security perspective, intelligence for that matter, and also global strategy? Because as passionate strategist on global scene that I am, I'm just curious how that translates from your perspective.
Yes, and it's only my viewpoint, but I feel like it's an informed one, and it makes me think of NORAD. I remember being a young man and watching the popular movie back in the 80s, where a computer comes alive and decides to have this its own war games, right?
Yes.
I remember thinking of NORAD and thinking of the technology that exists to wipe out humankind, and thinking, whoever has their fingers on those buttons, I sure hope they're calm and collected and smart and intentional about everything they do. And then I think about the different times that I've been associated with or interacted with or sometimes led from NORAD, or even now in Canada, looking at the 70-year legacy of NORAD, and think about how that legacy has unfolded. And it's a series of different transactions that has transformed the landscape of both the defense of North America and also the way people view the free world. It's because North America was free and protected not only by oceans, but by a coalition and a partnership that is probably the oldest one in human history now. And how it infects in a positive way the creation of NATO, the sustainment of the United Nations. It impacts things like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. These military decisions that were made just to protect our own people had a long-lasting effect on the rest of the global stage. And so, sure, we can look at the role of the military-industrial complex and military spending, but we can't deny that some of that has kind of squirted out and had really meaningful and positive impacts on the way we provide aid around the globe, or the way we think about helping our fellow human beings, or just the way we consider them, right? I don't have to speak loudly. I don't have to speak meanly. If I speak in a respectful tone and engage those stakeholders in a way that allows all of us to share our insights and come up with a collective decision, we're going to just be better together. And so it's important that we distinguish that we have a transactional decision to make, and we make some of those transactional decisions, understanding that when they combine, they become transformational. And I'm using my hands a lot, and you can see that, Isabella, but I'm kind of holding the globe in my hands. Because you think of the global stage now. That's just my kind of viewpoint on everything.
Love it. And I'm usually the one who use a lot of gestures and hands, and I was like passionate Croatian always being called, but it's funny. I love that because we are holding the globe in our hands without even recognizing or not. And I love that metaphor, but also the fact that truly depending of these choices, decisions, and as you said, very reactive versus proactive types of approaches can really make a huge and detrimental or extremely impactful outcome. And listening to you, obviously, your skill set, it's not just obviously tremendous emotional intelligence, social intelligence, but also emotional capacity, as you said, to stay calm, grounded, collected, to really feel the room and the present, understand where energy is, where dynamics are headed, what how things can quickly flame up and explode, or actually come down and switch. And that understanding from intelligence standpoint, it's so fascinating. Do you mind just share a little bit more about that? Because obviously we're looking from many roles that you played and continue to play, and understanding how this comes from organizational alignment, right? It's like, what is the core? What is the goal? What is the culture? What is okay? When we also see in times of diplomacy right now, chaos and vulgar language and discord and attack and all these very toxic negative types of behavior that actually are just showing the weaknesses, individual and collective, versus strength, and also how they affect strategic objective and frankly operational efficiency for that matter.
Absolutely. That's a lot to unpack. I'll give it a try and then keep me honest, right? I think there's an intersection of both the social intelligence and emotional intelligence that I'm privileged to have because of my upbringing. Both of my parents insisted on treating other people equally. We grew up kind of in this notion of the golden rule, which everybody's probably familiar with. Early on in my professional career, a number of people from different perspectives taught me the value and the importance of the platinum rule. I choose not to really link it to precious metals, but just talk about it as the human rule, meaning rather than treat people the way I want to be treated, I want to treat them the way they want to be treated. And spending time listening to what that is, how that unfolds, what that means to them is crucial. And so that's the listening part. The old adage of two ears and one mouth, I really think it's important to spend time listening and learning about what the needs of others are. We don't always have that opportunity, but whenever we do, we need to do that. That was essential to me in doing investigations and developing networks of people who could provide information, because I had to understand what was in it for them. You know, I had to understand why they had a motivation to work with the United States and to provide information to the United States that was sensitive and that then could be packaged in a way that was understandable to those critical decision makers, whether it was a general or a secretary, or a minister. I had to be able to do not so much a translation in terms of, you know, one language to another language, but also the meaning and the connotation that was involved and the emotion that was meant by it. From a leader perspective, what that taught me was it's okay for me to have outrage, to be furious, to be angry. I just need to manage the way I respond. And it's easy for me to fly off the handle and throw things across the room. But if I do that, I instantly betray the trust, the bond, the fragility of a relationship, whether it's one-on-one or one-on-many. And so as a leader, people need to see that you have emotion. You're not a robot. You need to be upset about something. You know, after 9/11, I was furious. I was angry. I was sad, just like so many people around the world were. But I couldn't overreact, and I couldn't act in a way that was unprepared or ununderstanding. And so learning to take a breath, to take a seat, to take a knee, to pause. And I refer to that now as a strategic pause in my own leadership and when I try to teach people about leadership. Taking that breath and having that pause is essential. And then finding ways to communicate what you see happening, solicit the input of what other people see happening, and then determining what we know and what we don't know so that we can move forward in what is often a chaotic environment that demands a lot of us.
Brilliant and so important. Again, at that self-awareness, but also I love how you took everything to the next level, treating others the way they want to be treated versus that old cliché, the way I want to treat it. That's why we always have that disconnect and clashing, because what is our norm versus theirs could be completely different. And as a result, if we're not aware of it, it's huge, huge detrimental issue when you're dealing with such a high level stakes like you're talking about here in high environments. So I'm curious also, how do you ensure this alignment between leadership vision and ground level execution with these high stake environments you're talking about, specifically that obviously can go in so many different directions, and keep that control of yourself and situation at the same time?
Yeah. So I think a lot of it starts with the ability to be both vulnerable and courageous. You know, when we there's a lot of information and courseware out there on the topic of trust. I think it is almost exclusively focused on the interpersonal trust, the trust between Isabella and Gus, rather than expanding that trust to how I do that from an alignment perspective in my organization. I talk a lot about something called the say-do gap, and it's a quadrant. In one corner, if what I say is what I do, then you and I are going to have a trustful relationship. In the opposite catty-corner quadrant, if what I don't say, I don't do, then that's also good. It's the other two quadrants that create disruption. The first one is I don't say something and then I do it. And that surprises us. And people don't like surprises. Even a lot of people don't like surprise birthday parties, right? Or surprise by the lottery. They want to have a predictable environment in which they live. So I want to avoid surprise, especially on the international stage and especially with those senior most decision makers. And that's where intelligence has always played a critical role because it can remove some pieces of that surprise. The other quadrant then is the I say something and fail to deliver, and or I say and don't do. And that's when people think that I'm lying. And sometimes it's absolutely just a lie. It's an intentional thing. And a lot of times it's because of an ignorance, or maybe I overpromise, under deliver, and I can't do something well. And so being vulnerable to the feedback to which of those quadrants I'm in requires courage. Hopefully, I have enough of both.
Yes.
We'd have to ask the people that work with me to find out if that's really the case. So I ask people how I'm doing. One of the companies I'm affiliated with in London that I do some coaching and consulting with taught me this notion of the EBI. And so a lot of Americans in particular are uncomfortable providing constructive criticism. And so
Yes.
turn that on its head. Great. This was an 80% success. Wonderful. Tell me what I can improve on. Well, and then there's this hemming and hawing, there's this tap dancing, there's this teeth sucking, and a reluctance to hurt my feelings. So the way we reframe that, is we say, give me an EBI. It would be even better if. And so I find that people are more comfortable saying, you know, that was an okay event. It would be even better if we did X, Y, and Z, or as I say in Canada up here, X, Y, and Z. And so finding little techniques as a leader for those small things, and then allowing people to have that conversation with you, and then tying that all together to the say-do gap matrix or quad chart is just one of the many tools that I look for from an alignment perspective. How's that for starter?
That's amazing. Again, I love it. And I love the EBI technique, because it's a combination of both, like not only to give, but also to receive, because we can feel it, intention behind it in the voice, nonverbal, verbal, and specifically how it's being delivered now, right? It's like, how is this going to person receive it? They're going to be open, or they're going to shut down, or they're going to not feel good about themselves. So obviously, Those are some of the really great strategies the corporate leaders can take it on. But I'm curious, what do you find, one, if you, beside these that you mentioned, if it's anything specific that you find that could be really helpful for corporate leaders to take actions today from intelligent leadership strategies? And the reason why I'm asking right now, we live in a world where the lowest trust in leadership is right now happening. And how do you affect that? How do you improve and change and also create the positive ripple effect with it?
Yeah, so that's the second part of when I talk about trust. The second part that people always forget is that you need to be consistent, transparent, accountable, and predictive. And so those are things that I've learned in my intelligence career, in my national security work, that when I am a leader and I'm not consistent about what I say, or I'm not consistent about following up, or I'm consistently over promising but under delivering, I lose reputation. I lose trust. I lose people over time. The organization starts to have attrition, whether that's a small unit, in a division, a cell, a team, or something like that, or whether that's an entire agency or department who feel that they've been betrayed. I've undermined that organizational trust. So I've got to have that consistency. The only way that we can start to repair that is not only to start changing the way we speak and do, but also advancing the amount of communication and transparency that we have. So
Yes.
talk a lot about doing things, but then we can't let people see it. So they need to be able to go and see those things on their own. They need to feel confident that it's believable, that it's true, that it's based on science and fact and true outcomes. And then we need to allow people to predict my behavior. So right now in the world, we have a lot of uncertainty. We have a lot of uncertainty in the United States and North America and around the globe. And that uncertainty creates panic. It creates
Yes.
an animosity and an anxiety in us as human beings, and then as us as kind of group behavior. And when we're anxious, we don't perform well, right? And we can't just tell people, trust me. Well, I want to trust you, but you're not showing me something that's trustworthy. Give me that consistency, give me that transparency, and then take that big leap, that third piece, and get to the predictability. If I can trust you, then I would expect you to behave in the following fashion. And then I can test my hypothesis, whether I'm, the average person sitting in the United States voting for somebody, or whether I'm an ally who's relying on me showing up to a war or providing a particular military device or doing some kind of sanction or not. And so all of those things get to alignment, and then we can break it down in different ways. There's the McKinsey 7S model, there's the STAR method, different ways that we can think about alignment, whether they're hard or soft skills, whether it's how I provide your appraisal, whether it's how I provide your feedback, whether it's the computer systems that we use. All of these things need to be intentional aspects of a leader's alignment when we start talking about organizational trust.
So true. It's like, does that matter? Are we talking about government entities or corporate or even nonprofit? It's just such a universal truth and how applicable that is, and how consistently we fail. Because looking at statistics, what's going on also with Fortune 500 companies, etc., it just give us really opportunity to start thinking, where we're consistently failing and what can we do better. Are we willing to look at the truth, right? And like data and statistics and again, transformation versus transaction, why we became so transactional and how this is now affecting everything else and the trust and long-term strategic partnerships, alliance and everything else, right? And then at the same time, how these biggest challenges that we're seeing align with this intelligence of organization and truly how to overcome them, right? Because we have plenty of problems, as you said. Question is again, who is leading and what type of leader is in an organization? So I'm curious, what do you see as a stepping stone for everybody watching and listening, specifically from a leadership perspective? They're scratching their head, they tried shortcuts and didn't work. What would you suggest for them?
There's no easy answer. So then that's always the hardest thing for us to hear, right? In a number of different courses I've taken over my years, everybody asks those really hard questions, and the kind of patent response is, it depends. I think that it depends is a bit of a cop out. So I think what we need to define is what we can depend on, and then identify the areas that we can't necessarily depend on, but that we're going to act towards, making the assumptions regardless, because we can't define those spaces. And so, as I think about that uncertainty and organizational alignment, what's important to me is saying, here's what I do know. I can rely on what I see on CNN or in Reuters or the Associated Press, and say, this is information. I can go to an academic institution like Harvard or Stanford and see that they're doing some good data-driven activity. I can go and mine information from the National Institutes of Health. All of those are good resources for me, and they're open. Then I need to ask people like myself, the intelligence community, these are publicly available bits of information. What else is out there that you can provide for me that tell me about the history, the intent, the activities of the people that we're looking at, whether that's an adversary or it's a competitor? We need to be able to predict with some level of confidence what they're going to do if we behave in a certain way. And for the commercial world, I think there's an awakening to that business intelligence piece, or some ways to repackage insights or reframe the way we look at the world, that the intelligence community, especially in democratic and free worlds, can inform. And so, what is it that the Fortune 500 company can take away from how the US government or Canada or NATO or the Five Eyes do in the intelligence spheres that, without breaking laws, without, violating our values and morals, as a society, could still give us a competitive advantage against the really, bad people out there who are waging war in places like the Ukraine, who intend to conduct terrorist activities, who intend to do harm against our people. And so, learning what that's like in a global environment that's so fast-paced requires that strategic leaders, that CEO, that COO, to apply resources and link it to a strategy with clear milestones and objectives, so that they can say if they're getting something that's giving them decision value, that's making their decisions better over time. Hopefully that answers your question.
Absolutely. And that is very powerful and a great point of view for people to really think about because times are gone when we just think that what we do here doesn't have a ripple effect and implication somewhere else and really brings a different makeup and different DNA of the legacy leader, of that individual that is continue to innovate, to be agile, nimble, but also resilient, right? With that intelligence and also with their leadership approach, which obviously you constantly evolving. I can tell that. And from, trajectory of your career and seeing how much you achieved, accomplished the milestones and continue to do that. So do you mind share a little bit of role of innovation and creativity that you firsthand did yourself, and that how that changed, how do you influence curricula, teaching style, future generation, but also integrate that from lens of innovation, but intelligence, national security, and leadership that feels like it's being almost like fragmented and bringing it now as a whole together.
Yeah, and I constantly feel like I'm on my heels, like I'm underprepared for a lot of kind of the technological advancements that we're enjoying today. I am competent and confident with my laptop and my desktop and my cell phone and the apps and the activities and the software that are on those things. I'm scared by things like AI. Not because necessarily of what AI can or cannot do, but because it intimidates me. And so I've worked really hard to embrace AI. I've got four or five different AI that are on my computers and on my smart devices so that I can experiment with them, whether it's crafting a resume, whether it's preparing a cover letter, whether that's working on a particular strategy. What I do know from having been a leader for so long is that I can't put too much faith in that technology. And so I might use AI to give me some competitive advantage or to help me think differently about things, but I can't rely on AI alone to do that. I can never shun the human beings that have so much potential already and have so many different ways of thinking. And so I try really hard to tap into people from a variety of different walks of life, different levels of influence, a lot of non-government folks as well as government folks. I love being in Canada and hearing the different Canadian perspectives as they pertain to the American perspectives. When they talk to me, they think I have a Southern accent. And I challenge somebody, I said, well, I'm not really from the South. And they said, well, sure you are. You're from America and we're up here in Canada. Well, that's a reframing that doesn't come naturally to me, but I absolutely get. And it may seem really simple, but Canada looks at the Arctic as their common area, whereas people in the United States view the Arctic as a distant place that somebody else has responsibility and claim to. And particularly our greatest allies, among some of our greatest allies, in like the Canadians. And so some of that resilience comes with some of that courage and vulnerability of saying, I don't know. I don't have a comprehension of this. I'm not an expert at that. And I need your help. I need to be vulnerable enough to say, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. What do you think? What is it that Isabella sees and can provide to the group that will create this amazing synthesis of all of our voices that give us greater power together?
Brilliant. I love how you, again, you walk your talk first, experiment with yourselves, build your own agility and resilience, and then look at how you can contribute that and disseminate across environments you in. And obviously, I love that you also mentioned how that helps you with your decision making, right? It's like, I have to face my fears. I have to deep dive into that. Obviously, challenge my leadership as well, assumptions of my intelligence. But I love also what you said with leveraging technology. That's tool. And it's not taking away, obviously, intelligence and leadership that you already know in your decision making. You're just there to support you, which obviously is fostering culture of innovation, big element to that. How do you see that done in traditionally very rigid environments right now? Institutions that we see that don't want to change, that they resist to change, and frankly, create a tremendous detriment, not only for themselves, but also everybody around them.
So it is something that I have struggled with. There's the Rogers adoption curve, and on the left side or the introductory part of the curve are those early innovators, right? Those people who embrace change comfortably and just grab it and go. And then as you kind of go up that curve, you kind of get to the early adopters and the mainstream, and then on the far side, you get these Luddites or the people who just refuse to change. Organizations are bureaucratic in nature, and they're always not always, they're often more in the middle of that center of mass to the left side because they're uncomfortable. They're not organized for change unless somebody goes in and intentionally builds them as a changing environment. We can see all sorts of corporate studies where one organization survives and thrives for a couple of years or a couple of decades, and then they lose their competitive advantage and they will die a painful death, or they'll figure out a way to revive themselves and embrace that innovation again. That's especially difficult in a government like we have in the United States, where we have to get Congress to make those changes for us. There's a military industrial complex that relies on being fed a large amount of money, and in turn, they employ a lot of people. So if I'm going to fire a bunch of people, or if I'm going to stop spending money on a particular platform in the military industrial community, then how do I shape that change in the small town that only survives because it makes the widget that goes into that thing? We're starting to see that in globalized corporations as well. If you look at those multinational and globalized corporations, there are whole towns that are dedicated to an aluminum plant or an auto manufacturing plant or even an innovation plant. And now that plant decides that they're going to move somewhere where labor's cheaper or pollution policies make it easier. And as a result, that town shrivels up and dies. How can we, as a in a social corporate responsible way, whether we're government or industry, establish ways that allow people to grow and evolve and don't put them in as much risk? And that is the challenge that I find both in government and in a lot of the kind of coaching and consulting I do on the side. Where I've succeeded at that has often been extreme vulnerability, where we go out and say, what's going to destroy us, and how do we incorporate those things into our work activities? Early on in the late 80s, it was how do we take acetate or transparency pieces of plastic that we're using grease pens and markers on to do a presentation and embrace what we used to call Harvard Graphics, now PowerPoint, to Prezi and now AI generated pieces of information that convey valuable information, but don't break the activities of the organization, but actually improve the activities of that organization. So it's very difficult, but I think the key is just being open to that change, finding a way to be comfortable enough with that change. You don't have to like it, but you have to find a way to live with it because it's inevitable.
I love that perspective, specifically as you said, it is inevitable, and everybody needs to find ways to be more easily adapted to, because more we resist, more persistence and more conflict and more delays. And sometimes we can really obviously have those depending on what we're dealing, specifically when you're dealing with national security and things of such a high level of importance. But we mentioned earlier a little bit, just briefly, emotional intelligence components to that, and also your social intelligence that are so important in my mind as a holistic approach to leadership. And also, when we look at things from lens of servant leadership, for example. So I'm curious, obviously, critical role of emotional intelligence in national security and leadership. We've seen of so many things that are happening, and a lot of people are like, as you, and I love what you use that quadrant and visual that I could just see it as you were explaining. But why we're bringing this up is the traits again, that we are seeing that are missing, and key ingredients in order to truly be the successful, not only in fostering the change and executing that change, but also be able to maintain that change. So I'm curious, how do you see what leadership traits right now more than ever are needed to be successful in national security today?
Yeah, in fact, we just had some conversation about that in the past week, and I think it starts with an acknowledgement of each other's humanity. There are a lot of we can look up on Google any number of fallacies that flaw our own thinking. And one of the easy traps for me, especially as a young leader, was the fallacy of mirror imaging. And it wasn't until people were brave enough to challenge my own perception and my wrong perception, by the way, that allowed me to say, you know what, you're right. And it was a line of questioning that my mom also gave me that I just resisted because it was my mom and I was a young man, right? Like, I don't need my mommy's advice now. I'm a grown man, but I rely on my mommy's advice today in my mid-50s, right? And I'm proud of that, and I can talk about that. And one of those things is a set of questions that say, if you were that person, how would you feel? And I pause and I think about that. If I did it this way, what would that look like to somebody else? And I pause and think about that. What makes me come to that conclusion? And I pause and think about that. Why do you think somebody else feels differently? Or what is it that somebody else sees that makes them come to a different conclusion? And those are the kinds of questions that swirl around in the back of my mind, whether I'm watching the news and some really inflammatory, headline grabbing articles on the news, or whether it's somebody who comes into my office and they're kind of frantic and they feel like the sky is falling. And sometimes the sky is falling. We just have to see it from their perspective. And then, so understanding that humanistic perspective is important, and then applying an element of compassion that isn't necessarily pity, right? We can be sympathetic. We can offer our own feelings in response. We can't know what it's like for them. And I've been talking a lot as I face retirement now about the death of my younger brother, the unexpected death of my younger brother due to malpractice. And it was shocking. But the way people come to you after a tragedy like that and they say, oh, I know how you feel. It's impossible that you know how I feel. And that's okay. Let me acknowledge that. And so that changed the way since then I've responded to other people, both as a friend and hopefully as a consoling leader when other people endure that kind of hardship. I can't know how you feel. What I do know is that you feel a lot of pain and I can relate to that pain. I know you feel a lot of anger and I can relate to that anger. And I can be here with you and not offer a solution and still offer support. And sometimes that's what a leader really needs to be able to do, is not try to fix something, rather just be there and support, because sometimes it just can't be fixed.
So powerful, specifically that servant leadership where you are there to serve others. And I love from mentorship coaching perspective as a fellow coach myself, and I've seen a lot of times people make that mistake. And I love how you make that huge distinction there, because obviously everything is personal, right? Nobody can say or downplay or overplay somebody's impact of something when they say, you know, it's no big deal. We don't know if it's a big deal or not. And we can only ask other person to share how they're feeling and what is really, as you said, why is this important to them, or why is the sky falling for them in their mind, and then come from that angle. But if we're downplay, underplay, or just simply ignore, we miss huge opportunity to connect and frankly to discuss discover more things that we don't know, that we're not aware of. And as a result, outcomes are completely different, aren't they?
Yeah, so true. And the other thing that I've really embraced is a willingness to be. So there's this artificial machismo, particularly in the United States right now, that a man can't cry, or a man needs to behave this way and a woman needs to behave that way. I don't want to impose that on anybody. I don't want to put you in a straitjacket. I can tell you that I've cried, and I've cried like the day I came out as a baby, and that's all right. And I've watched other combat veterans do the same. And there are people that I've talked to who are veterans of the Ukraine crisis right now, who've come over to Canada and in the United States, who I've had the opportunity to sit down with, and they've broken down crying and they apologize. And I don't want them to feel bad about that. They don't need to apologize. What I need to do is give them the space for them to be vulnerable so that we can advance our relationship together, so we can focus on what might be fixed and how I might be able to help that. So I'm really glad that we can talk a little bit about that.
That's brilliant. First of all, I want to acknowledge your loss of your brother that you mentioned for malpractice. That's also very difficult to accept, specifically when somebody's young life is due to negligence taken away, or when you're talking about speaking with those warriors in Ukraine, when you see so much conflict in media, what is going on in propaganda, etc., but then also what they really experience on a daily basis and how little accuracy is being portrayed in modern time war in Europe specifically. I grew up in Europe. And then also, I love what you said, how can you bring yourself fully and embrace the person fully so that they can show vulnerability, not the weakness, and also be able to tell you fully what it is like to be in trenches and what type of psychology and processes are going on right now and what their day look like, and that gets a sense of reality so we know then what's the best way to help them. Unless we know, we just assume we're neglecting truly to fully be able to unfold and provide something that can be impactful as a meaningful. And I love that side of intelligence and probing and trust building that you're such a great expert at it. But I'm also sure that that has a tremendous impact on also decision making and crisis management. Do you mind share a little bit what do you do with that and how do you create as a result phenomenal impactful outcomes?
So, as we talked about this before we started recording, a couple of things came to mind that I think are really important to any leader. And that is, in a crisis, the first thing that we want to do is react to what we see. And at the international or even at the national level, those first reports are often inaccurate or one-sided or lopsided. So it's easy to be infuriated by some kind of thing. And so that's the, I it brings me back to that strategic pause, but being able to identify that this raises my ire, and knowing that that's part of the issue. The next issue then is trying to create that calm in the people around you, and doing so in a way that doesn't belittle the way they're feeling. And then the third is finding ways to go out and intentionally get the information you want. And if you wait until a crisis to go and gather that information and develop those revenues or excuse me, avenues of information, you're behind schedule. You have to start doing that way before a crisis. So whether you're a government leader, a nonprofit, or an industry leader, identifying what those outlets are for information that you're going to need to make those decisions must happen before a crisis, because there's going to be stuff that you don't know when that crisis hits, and you're still going to have to invent new ways to find new information. Having more of that homework done up front is going to make that a lot easier to live with. And the last is, there's a especially in crises on the international stage, 9/11's easy. We wanted instant vengeance, right? When what we really need to remember as strategic leaders is, if we overreact now, we're going to make it worse. I think about when there's a fire in my kitchen, if I throw water on it because that's what I think is going to put the fire out, I've actually made the fire worse if it's an oil fire or a grease fire, right? I don't want to do that as a strategic leader. I don't want to fan the flames or inflame or make another problem for myself that now makes it more intractable. And I think a lot of that still comes back to that legacy of trust in my behavior and my words. And so the challenge is finding the right words at the right time that meet those needs. And the things that Isabella and Gus need to hear aren't necessarily what Joe or Susie or Bob or Matilda need to hear. And I'm just making words up now, but having an appreciation for that on the global stage and how the press may report it is all really important.
And why it's important is to have that in honest, truthful, accurate delivery and also reporting. So because again, how much that weighs in with everything else and the noise that we're in. So when I just reflect just in this conversation thus far, how rich and impactful this episode alone is, and how important it is to continue to share these types of wisdom and also practical application, but also perspectives that so many people truly don't have or not have opportunity to sit down on daily basis and have access to guests or expert on so many topics and so many levels, but yet how we can also learn from another and be able to share information of the value and impact, which I first of all want to say thank you. This is tremendously impactful from my perspective. Cannot wait from my listeners and viewers. But I'm curious now from closing, what would you say one of the principles as a national security principle that you think that everybody can implement in times like this, or one piece of advice from leadership strategic process that they could truly move the needle in the right direction when it's a chaos, crisis, and so many challenges around everybody glooming every day.
So one of the things that I've been talking to, whether it's my students or my colleagues or my leaders about for decades now, is this notion of VUCA, of volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And you've talked a little bit about this in some of your previous podcasts. And I live and my bosses live in a VUCA environment all day. A former Undersecretary of Defense told me that he only gets problems. He doesn't have the luxury of dealing with something that's simple, that's obvious, or even something that's complicated. Everything that lands on their desk is already chaotic or complex. And the key is acknowledging that it's chaotic or complex and saying, I don't know the answer. And having the courage to say, I don't know, and being able then to form a coalition and invite that coalition to help solve the problem. And the coalition's going to come together in our world. We're still not going to know. We are going to know enough to start dealing with it, right? Whether it's a wildfire that is just undermining national security, or whether it's a war, or whether it's a climate crisis. All of the things that are going on, we can take small steps that slowly remove some of that complexity, some of that difficulty in the decision making, and then more becomes clear. So the things that I try to protect as a strategic leader are time and space. And space, sometimes it's geographic space, like a hectare of space if I'm in battle. But more importantly, what I'm talking about is decision space. So how much time can I buy myself if I pause and say, I don't know? And how much decision space can I buy myself if I say, let's come back to that and deal with what we do know for now? And the pausing and creating that time and space for myself and for my leaders, for my decision makers, and for the stakeholders who are on the team is critically important at that strategic level. I think that's true whether you're leading a nonprofit or if you're a captain in industry or if you're a government leader. And so it's really important for me to create as much time and space as I can for me and for my team and for others whom I work with. So, and then deny that. If I am in a truly competitive way, deny that time and space to my adversary or my competitor.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I love that. So many golden nuggets and so many great ways to lead better, adjust, but also make a tremendous impact and difference. And in closing, I really would like to obviously tell everybody where they can get in touch with you. But before we do that, I was just checking your LinkedIn profile and I saw really intriguing photo. So you have to tell me the story behind the hat that you have in that photo on LinkedIn.
Yeah, thanks for asking and thanks for noticing. I tease people that I have a face for radio, meaning I've never considered myself particularly good looking, but I do like to look good, right? And so my wife and I were headed out to a black tie event, and I felt like donning a hat. And I have a hat that is a gift and a memento and a piece of heritage in my family that belonged to my grandpa. My maternal grandfather, and he wore that hat as a young man. In fact, the picture is behind me. Your viewers can't see it, but it's behind me of my grandfather, and I remember him wearing hats like this. And this hat is probably 100 years old, and I just put it on. And my grandfather was one of the people who initially left wisdom marks on me in an amazing way. And one of the things that I remember him telling me the most of was about religion. And he was a very religious and spiritual man. And he said, we're all trying to get to the same place. So don't judge people on the religion or the path that they choose if you know that they're trying to get to the place that's awfully darn similar to the place that we describe in our own religious profession. And I was probably 8, 9, 10 when he shared that with me. And there are so many other imprints that he's left on my psyche and on my soul that I'll never forget. And he was such an important human to me that we gave his surname to our son as his middle name, just so that we can remember that legacy. And when my wife said, hey, maybe you try this hat on, I thought that's a great idea. And then when I thought maybe I need to, as I start thinking about chapter three and retiring from government service, maybe I need to freshen up my LinkedIn profile. I thought that's a good picture, and it's meaningful to me, and it's eye-catching. So I'm really glad that you noticed that. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to tell that little story.
Fantastic, love it. And it's great to see who are those role models to build us up in early ages and who we will look up to. And then also, as a result, others now looking up to you for everything that you do. So, Gus, for everybody that wants to connect and reach out after listening to this podcast, would you please tell us where they can find you?
I think the best way for your listeners to reach out to me is on LinkedIn. I'm Gustav Otto, on LinkedIn, and I welcome building a community of other people who want to learn with me, and I will learn from. And so I'm looking forward to connecting with even more people around the globe.